I was recalling a story that I read some years ago in one of those Buddhist magazines that was something like this woman who's writing the true story goes into a coffee shop, a cafe, and one morning and gets a cup of coffee, and she's glad that she brought her bag of cookies with her in her purse, and she gets a newspaper and she sits down and starts enjoying Sunday morning and reading the paper and picking up a cookie from the counter, eating it, and then has a sip of coffee, and then at the counter there's a guy next to her who's same thing, he's kind of having a cup of coffee and reading a paper, and he reaches over and takes a cookie. And she's like, that's kind of strange. He didn't even ask. Did anybody read this story? And so it goes on that way. She takes another cookie, and periodically he takes another cookie too, but they don't say anything to each other. They just keep reading the paper. But she's getting a little bit annoyed because they're her favorite kind of cookie, and you know, she was really wanting to enjoy this bag of cookies this Sunday morning. So keeps going this way. Every time she takes one, he takes one shortly afterwards, and she's getting more and more annoyed, and like she can't believe he doesn't even say anything, but she's not going to say anything at this point. It's just like it's actually too weird. And and it gets down to there's what, like one cookie left, and and he you know, kind of casually while reading the paper, breaks it in half, eats half, and kind of like pushes the plate a little towards her. She can have the last half. And she's totally enraged at this point and can't believe that somebody could do such a thing. And but finishes the half cookie, finishes her coffee, throws down the paper and leaves, and gets in her car and reaches into her purse for the car keys, and there's a bag of cookies there. The same kind that she was just eating in an unopened bag. And she's shocked even more now. Her mind totally turns. She feels so ridiculous that not only was you know, she getting so upset with this person eating her cookies, but she was eating his cookies. And he was even so kind as to like split the last one with her. So this is a mind-only story. kind of a coarse mind-only story. In that it's just the basic principle that what we think is going on is often not really what's going on, and it's our own mind's creation. The actual situation is quite different, even though we are completely convinced, so convinced that we don't even really question, we just assume. It's like we don't even assume. It's like beyond assuming. It's just like the normal state of affairs. And yet, the normal, totally unquestioned reality is often, maybe we could say, never that the case that we think it is. So I say it's kind of a rough, coarse story because this principle of not believing what we think runs through all of Buddha's teachings, and we hear in many different ways this teaching and practice, and it's this greatly beneficial teaching because this is the cause of, well, basically all our problems, is that we believe what we think. So the different traditions of Buddha Dharma help with this in different ways, but what's called the mind-only school that we're taking up this practice period goes even further than most. Not only would the mind-only view say that those are not her cookies, but it would say also they're not his cookies, and in fact they're not even cookies, or maybe more accurately, the cookies are not something external to mind. They're a mental fabrication. So, same idea in the school of not believing our stories, but it just gets into very, very subtle stories. And I was talking about this with people earlier, and in Monterey last night, and I think it may not have been so clear to just dive right into this point that there's no external world and those stories. It seems like that, you know, this book is not apart from the mind. We think, well, wait a second, what's this have to do with our suffering and problems? And compared to like the problem that the woman was in the cafe, where like somebody's taking my cookies. You know, if it was more like the view of it's my book, that's a kind of a coarser view. And that actually causes more problems, to think that it's my book and somebody tries to take it or it gets stolen and then I'm sad. But to say that it's like actually the book's not even apart from mine, why bother with this kind of level of investigation? And again, it's the same principle. It's just taking that principle of our stories or our mind's creations of the world as far as it'll go, which is basically everything that we think and even that we perceive on a pre-conceptual level as that we perceive as external to mind. It's going there too and questioning that reality. And it's quite a subtle view, so the discussion came up, well, if people are kind of newer to practice, which could be like all of us with such a subtle view, maybe we shouldn't be working with such subtleties. We should start unraveling our more coarse stories first. And I think that's true. There's validity to that. I think this kind of subtle story, if we can really start to open to that that way that all our thoughts and perceptions of the world are distorted by this duality that the mind creates, that subtle understanding can apply to coarse problems too. And so that's one, you know, even though it may be more difficult, if we could realize mind only, then all our kind of coarser, basic, regular old run-the-mill day-to-day problems would be seen in a very different light also. And if that's not so convincing and we still feel like, well, I want an easier approach here, I'm not ready for this difficult one, I could understand that, and we'll hear all different kinds of practice instructions for working with our stories and our mind. in this life and in this Zen center. But I still feel compelled to march forward with this presentation of mine only, partly just to remind us all that that the Buddha's teachings are incredibly profound and vast, and we might feel like, well, I just want some basic stuff. I'm having enough trouble just doing the basic practice. Then I think that's, we work on whatever practice we need to work on. And yet, to know that the scope and vastness of this path is beyond just a, you know, basic trying to relax and calm down and be kind of present. Those are essential, crucial practices and wonderfully helpful practices. And yet, we may, we may lose interest more easily in the whole path of practice if we think that's all that it's about. Maybe I speak for myself, maybe others wouldn't lose interest, and maybe I wouldn't either. But personally for me, it's what keeps me going with as much wholeheartedness as I can muster forth in this practice is the potential for the vastness of the liberation possible for all beings. So even if this seems too difficult and impossible, just to be open to the possibility that this type of view, this type of teaching is incredibly profound and can actually literally save the world. Save the world from being put external to our mind. And another point about compassion, which can't be emphasized enough, and in these types of teachings that can sound kind of complicated and sound like, well, then if there's really nothing out there, it could feel like those kinds of things are undermining compassion and undermining our helpfulness in the world, because the world is not apart from mind. So if it's really just our mind, then why would we care about how it goes? In a dream, why does it matter so much what happens in the dream? We might ask. So I think it's good to keep remembering these questions and look at them from different angles. So today's angle on that is, well, for one thing, if it really is all a dream, all a mind creation for each of us, then when we see others appearing to suffer in this dream, it's because, according to this teaching, the reason that others and ourselves are suffering is because we're taking the dream too seriously. We're reifying it. We're thinking it's not just a dream. Therefore, we suffer. I don't know if that seems clear that that's so, but that seems to be the proposal of the mind-only school. But I would say of all of Buddha's teachings, we suffer because we attribute too much reality to a dreamlike version of our experience. So if we see others appearing to suffer, we could deduce that it's because, like us, they are taking the dream too seriously, and therefore our motivation to help them, help the dream beings become free from the dream that they're in, can increase. It's kind of a weird story in a way, but I think it seems to be the case. And also that our compassion, in the sense of kind of like active compassion, like the inspiration that actually this is a workable situation and people really can be helped, people really can be freed from suffering, I think, in other words, like, it doesn't seem so hopeless. I think this positive aspiration to help can also be increased from this view, because we see that actually the suffering of the world is just this hair's breadth deviation from, you know, this shift of vision. Does that make sense? Like, if we could, if all the beings in the world could just, which, you know, it's maybe a tall order to shift vision like that, right? But if everybody could see the kind of dreamlike quality of what they attribute to their experience, attributing it reality to the dream, then then they could just be completely freed on the spot, right? There's this potential. Maybe difficult. It's just a small shift with a huge effect. Like one teacher said, metaphorically, it's like stepping onto the wrong airplane at the airport. In other words, it's like, there's just two different, you know, aisles to two different airplanes. They're right next to each other. Stepping on this one's not that far apart from stepping on this one, but the result is huge, right? Because this one's going to Africa and this one's going to Australia. So a little different step creating a huge, huge difference. And maybe we can see that, even if we're just open to this vision, we might not be able to fully realize this truth of mind only in this lifetime. But the more we're open to it, the more this seems possible, that we see that everybody is equally, has the potential to be equally open to it. Is this making sense? Almost like the more it seems that this little step could be like, literally could save the world, you know, that the potential for helping those beings is so great. And you could say, well, the help there would just be like helping them to shift vision like that. And in fact, that's Buddha's compassion, is actually helping people to see the world differently. But Buddha's compassion also manifests in more conventional ways too, like just being kind to people, because that's necessary also. And also in this, if it's a dream world and we're all dream beings that are basically like over solidifying our dreams, then we're all kind of in the same boat, so we can also feel this kind of closeness, as opposed to a separation, like they're just like these automaton dream beings and they're not really real at all. Quite the opposite. It's more like, wow, this, in this strange vision, strange but seemingly more accurate vision, seemingly to me anyway, it's like we share this kind of dream world, and yet we suffer and we are very unkind to each other, all due to believing in the dream world, right? This is how wars happen, because it's like, no, that really is like my country, and the border line is really right there. Like, no, it's over there. Well, let's like kill each other. Like, what a bad dream. It doesn't need to be that way. But it's because we're taking too seriously the political border in the dream world. It's too serious. It's not worth dying over. So that's a little bit of a strange, maybe kind of explanation of compassion in the mind-only school, which we may not want to lose sight of. So here's another story, a Zen story, related to this. Case number 80 in the Blue Cliff Record collection of koans, called Zhaozhou's Newborn Baby. A monk asked Zhaozhou, does a newborn baby also have the sixth consciousness? Zhaozhou said, like tossing a ball on swift flowing water. The monk also asked Totsu, Zhaozhou's Dharma brother, what's the meaning of tossing a ball on swift flowing water? Totsu said, moment to moment, non-stop flow. So then the commentary by what's his name? Yuan Wu. Kind of summarizes very nicely the eight consciousness system of the mind-only school that we've been talking about in class. So this is kind of unusual, especially for Yuan Wu and the Blue Cliff Record, to kind of go into this exposition of a Buddhist philosophical school. He usually doesn't talk this way. So this is a kind of like special thing he's doing here, which he does kind of briefly. He says, in the teaching school, this is a way of talking about the Buddhist schools other than Zen, the schools that have actual teachings. Zen doesn't have that. In the teaching school, the eighth consciousness is set up as the true basis. So the eighth consciousness is the storehouse consciousness. It's the basis of all. Mountains, rivers, and the great earth, sun, moon, and stars come into being because of it. There it is. Mind only. What seems to be the external world, mountains, rivers, the great earth, sun, moon, and stars all come into being because of the eighth consciousness. Pretty big and unusual statement. But that's what we've been talking about. According to this school. And if it's just that, if that just seems like a completely absurd statement, what if you say our experience of mountains, rivers, and earth, sun, moon, and stars, then it maybe gets much more easy to swallow, right? But if so, just so we don't become too complacent and like, oh, well, we're just talking about experience, there really is the sun, moon, and stars, you know, apart from our experience. Well, the school questions that. How would we ever possibly know? All we have ever in this life is our experience, the only way we can ever know anything. The ancients say that the triple world is only mind. The three realms are mind only. From the Avatamsaka Sutra. The myriad things are only consciousness. If one experiences the stage of Buddhahood, the eight consciousnesses are transformed into the four wisdoms. In the school of the teachings, they call this changing names, not changing essence. And that's a whole other part of the system, how the eight consciousnesses are transformed into the four wisdoms. But we'll get into that now. Sense faculties, sense objects, and consciousness of sensation are three. So there's the sense organs, the faculties, the objects, and consciousness are three. Originally, we are unable to discriminate among the sense objects before us, but the subtle inner faculties can produce consciousness, talking about mental consciousness here, and consciousness can reveal discrimination of forms. So, saying the sense consciousnesses cannot discriminate among the objects, like they can't say this is blue and this is brown. they just perceive this is blue, and then they perceive this is brown, but they can't tell like a difference between them. They're very simple, the sense, five sense consciousnesses. They just receive sensory data, and they don't compare it to other moments of that happening. They're completely present, direct experience. And in and of themselves, we can't know anything about their activity except through the sixth consciousness, the mental consciousness. There's a direct perception of blue here, but we don't know that we're perceiving the blue without the sixth consciousness, the mental, which is the one in the story here. Does a newborn baby have the sixth consciousness? So the sixth consciousness, conceptual thinking, that can discriminate between forms. The seventh consciousness is manas. It can go take hold of the imaginary things of the world and cause a person to be vexed and troubled so that he doesn't attain freedom. So that's the story we've been hearing. As for the eighth consciousness, it's called Alaya Vijnana and called the storehouse consciousness. It contains all the seeds of good and bad and so on. So that's his kind of summary of the eight consciousnesses, which sounds quite accurate according to the teaching schools. This monk in the story knew the ideas of these teachings, so he used them to question Zhaozhou by saying, does a newborn baby also have the sixth consciousness or not? Although a newborn baby is equipped with the six consciousnesses, though his eyes can see and her ears can hear, she still doesn't yet discriminate among the six sense objects. At this time, that baby knows nothing of good and bad, long and short, right and wrong, gain and loss. at least that's the proposal. And we're talking about really a newborn baby for, I don't know how long, a couple days, a couple months. We can speculate by observing them. We can do various experiments on an upcoming baby. Zen experiments. But that seems to be the case, right? A newborn baby seems to interact with the world. Definitely, all its five senses are operating very vividly. It's taking in tons of information, but it's, at least very early on, it doesn't seem to be able to discriminate much. Maybe, we don't know, but maybe not even between like colors and sounds. It's just like all this, you know, overwhelm, flood of information. And then as the sixth consciousness starts to get trained, it starts to be able to start to distinguish, okay, that's a sound and that's a color. And then it starts to learn, even before words and language, it starts to learn to distinguish things, which makes it possible then for when it can start doing the word language thing, then it's already got this whole setup. So then very quickly it can go boom, 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 boom. Floor, ceiling, platform, wall, window, door. It's got all these objects already discriminated, so it just starts labeling them. Sometimes making up its own, and then, learns to go along with our special dream of English language, co-created dream. So, a person who studies the way must become again like an infant. I think Jesus said the same thing. Yeah? Lest ye become as little children, ye cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. But this is not just little children now, this is infant mind. We have the six consciousnesses very well trained to discriminate among all these things, but to be able to, maybe in Zazen, and then just for fun in the dream world, to just not get into that. Even if the mind's naturally discriminating, just don't go there. Just don't even have to say, is this a book and is this a table? And so a lot of these Zen stories start sounding like that. Like, don't they know what things are called? These people are talking in a really weird way sometimes. A mind like an infant. Then praise and blame, success and fame, unfavorable circumstances and favorable environments, none of these can move the person around. Though the eyes see form, one is the same as a blind person. Though the ears hear sound, one's like a deaf person. Like a fool, like an idiot, the mind as motionless as Mount Sumeru. This is the place where patrobe monks really and truly acquire power. Samadhi power, you could say. This image of the blind and deaf person is kind of interesting because another one of the teachers, non-Zen teachers, commenting metaphorically on how these consciousnesses work, said that the first five sense consciousnesses are like a mute person that with really clear vision. In other words, they can see everything really clearly, but they can't talk about it. And the sixth consciousness is like a blind person who's a really good speaker. Can you follow that? So they can work together that way. Like the mute person can see things, but they can't say anything about what color it is or anything. But they perfectly clearly see and sense the world, see, hear, smell, taste, and touch the world. And then somehow mysteriously they're in cahoots with the sixth consciousness that actually it's blind, actually can't really see directly these colors and things, but it can talk about them a lot and discriminate, like, that's blue and that's red and so on. So they have these different functions. One's like directly experiencing, can't do anything about it. One's like not really directly experiencing, indirectly experiencing through the use of the sense consciousnesses, but it can do all kinds of discrimination among these kind of somewhat false or not so accurate perceptions, the sixth consciousness. And then we have the seventh consciousness, called manas, that's like the sense of a personal self in the school. There's a new consciousness is added into the first six. The seventh consciousness is the sense of me. Kind of strange that they did that, huh? In this system. They made up a special consciousness for a sense of a personal self. All schools of Buddhism talk about that there is this sense of a personal self, of an I, but they say this is so important in terms of bondage and liberation, this little thing that we do called thinking that I'm here is, let's actually call it a seventh consciousness. And that actually that's like the mental organ, the mind organ, or mind faculty, I could say, is this sense of self, and that it uses the sixth consciousness to perceive what seems to be the things of the world, but what it's actually perceiving is this, all the stuff that's in this storehouse consciousness that we call the world, that's constantly being churned up and presented in the form of like zendos and people and stuff like that. That all this stuff is in the storehouse consciousness. It gets, you know, tricky to talk about this because it's not actually a storehouse with things in it. It's more like it is just this collection of everything we experience, and it's all not separate from mind. This story might start sounding more and more weird for people that haven't heard it before, but it's a dream. It's a story, but it's an interesting one because it's actually talking about the dream. It's a kind of unique dream within a dream. And though basically the storehouse is a storehouse of illusions, mostly that's what it is. It's all these, it's been created through our illusory thinking, and it just keeps reinforcing itself and collecting more and more illusory, external items, externally appearing things. It also, according to some ancients, contains these seeds. All these, you know, illusions are sometimes called seeds. It has a few seeds in there that are like wisdom seeds, that are like, this is one part of some people's story, like Asanga, the founder of the tradition, had this very nice story, I think, that it's not just a storehouse of total suffering, misery, and confusion, that it actually stores these like wisdom seeds. They're not something, but they're like the potential to actually understand that the whole thing is a dream. They're like dream dispelling seeds. And most people never access them because there's not so many of them, maybe, and they have to be accessed in very like very careful and concentrated ways. So that's what we're doing here, you could say. Telling these kinds of stories is like we're starting to like shine flashlights down these dark paths, at the end of which maybe these dream dispelling seeds. And but these paths are very dark and narrow, and it's very tempting to just think that this is just a crazy story, and who wants to go down a dark path looking for some dream dispelling seed anyway? How absurd. It's like science fiction. So The story, though, I think is quite straightforward, because it's just saying that to be like an infant is like our discriminating consciousness is like basically totally out of control. It's like tossing a ball on a swift-flowing river. And it, because it's a Zen story, Jiaozhou is responding to the person in the moment too. Like, right now what's happening is like a ball being tossed on a swift-flowing river. Like, I gotta get a hold of it! It's like, as I say in some point in here, it's like, pick it up later on the shore. It's like, that thing is like, you can't stop it to look at it. None of this, nothing ever can we actually stop to look at. And this is like the sixth consciousness, this conceptual mental consciousness. So just to clarify even more, the monk asked Totsu, what's the meaning of tossing a ball on swift flowing river? And the teacher says, moment to moment, non-stop flow. So it seems that whether we like it or not, we can't stop this flow. And so how to, in the midst of all these things and trying to unravel the mysteries and searching down dark alleys for dream-dispelling seeds and all of this, meanwhile, there's this moment-to-moment non-stop flow. And and that's actually our Zazen practice. Well, maybe we should say, like, particularly the calm abiding practice, when we're really settling, and whether we're following the breath or just resting in the present moment. I think either one of those practices, they basically, that's using the sixth consciousness. We're basically, we're tuning the sixth consciousness to be very still or to be very calm, maybe. It's still like a ball flowing on swift river, but it's like really settling into the moment-to-moment non-stop flow. Now, whether we say that's complete Zazen, that's maybe a longer discussion. I would offhand say no, that actually what we call dropping off body and mind is not the sixth consciousness. It's actually dropping off the sixth consciousness. But our basic meditation practice of resting in the present or following the breath, we're using this great gift of this flowing sixth consciousness. The last line of the verse on this story says, where it comes down, it doesn't stay. Who can watch it? Which may sound like our Zazen practice. So, do you have any questions or comments? Jean?
It seems like it's fair to say that we're in the school of cultivating direct experience. What you just described in Zazen practice. And this seems like it contradicts directly mind only.
I think that that when we say just resting in the present and receiving what's happening, in that kind of basic way that's accessible any moment, I would say technically, according to this kind of way of talking, that wouldn't really be called direct experience. That it's still it's a conceptual experience, but conceptual experience, just conceptual experience, is sometimes said to be the realization of the mind-only school. Like Vasubandhu calls the highest realization attainment, the attainment of mere concept. So, and I would say even, we're not just talking about when we're thinking, realizing that it's mere concept, but even in Zazen, and I think that's what he's actually talking about, Vasubandhu, attainment of mere concept. Even we're very still, and we're not like activating the mind around all kinds of things, this is still a dualistic consciousness, the sixth consciousness. It's and it's a conceptualized version of what's happening. We sometimes might call it now. It's a moment in time that's not past or future. Very subtle concept called now, but in a way you could say it's not the direct experience. Well, direct sensory experience doesn't have time, including now. It's free of free times. So this may be hard to follow what I'm talking, but I would say what we sometimes think of as direct experience, I would say in terms of these teachings, I call it actually conceptual, but we can get to the point where it's merely conceptual and not reified as like, no, this really is a time called now, or this really is like a body sitting still, or anything, any other subtle thoughts that might arise during Zazen. We could go on in that way, but that, it's a great point, actually. I think we should explore more what is this, what is direct experience. Also, because also there can be, the sixth consciousness can have direct experience, according to this system. Usually it doesn't, but for example, the direct realization of emptiness, at least in some systems, is a, it's the sixth consciousness having a direct perception. It's not sensory consciousness. It's the mental consciousness having a direct perception, meaning non-dual perception. Like, it's not an idea of emptiness. It's like the perceiver and the perceived. The perceiver of emptiness and the perceived emptiness are non-dual. And so you could say the sixth consciousness is direct then, but then we get into this issue of the how the consciousnesses, which are inherently dualistic, get transformed into the wisdom, as the teaching said, non-dual wisdom. So if we're saying direct experience is non-dual experience, then the consciousnesses, that's impossible for a vijnana, for a divided knowing, to have a non-dual experience, even though there could be direct perception. So these are a lot of words that sound similar and we should distinguish, but we probably don't have time to now. But there's a little, some thoughts anyway, around this point. Yeah, Johnny.
Some anecdotal stuff that how I can grasp this at the moment. I was induced at 8 months. My daughter, elder daughter, just popped out at 7 months. My younger daughter was full term. My wife was full term. I tended to be feral, always left the cocoon. My older daughter is feral. She came out that way too. I say this because what I understand is there seems to be a kind of karmic inheritance that I can associate with eighth consciousness. There are potentials in there. There are probabilities in there all mixed up that just seem different. Person to person, perhaps. There is a seventh consciousness which identifies with the differences that I see from person to person.
And thinks of them as mine.
My personality, I am feral.
I am this, I am that.
So, to go to Jean's point, what I'm experiencing is something like this, that when I practice Zazen, dropping off of mind and body is dropping off of seventh and eighth consciousness and residing in the sixth consciousness. karmic inheritance, and I have less investment in owning it in that sense, and I'm more accessible to what's happening.
Yeah, I think there's different, it depends, zazen's a broad term that could apply to many things. So I think you could look at it as we're dropping off the activity of the seventh and eighth is maybe more, particularly the seventh, and that the sixth is like the last thing where it can get really, really still. But then, I think of the Fukan Zazengi, when we say, give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. That's a translation of these very terms. It's using these mind-only terms. Give up the sixth, seventh, and eighth consciousness. Literally, it says in the Fukan Zazengi. And also, if you look at in the transmission of light, the story on Dogen, the Kazon's commentary on Dogen's story, he gets very into this eight consciousness system, and in the koan at hand is Dogen's dropping off body and mind. So he says in there, dropping off body and mind is dropping off all eight of these. So it can get quite subtle, and in the Tibetan teachings too, they often talk about if it's shamatha, even unsupported shamatha, which we might often think of as shikantaza, we might think of as unsupported shamatha, meaning no object, no particular object, just resting in the present, and yet it's still subtly dualistic. So for unsupported shamatha, that's still using the sixth consciousness, but for the great perfection, Dzogchen, complete non-dual meditation, it's not the sixth consciousness anymore. So, but for our purposes in daily zazen, we maybe aren't going to get into this kind of complete non-dual realm anyway. So I think the sixth consciousness is what we're using for basic zazen practice, for especially calm abiding.
Is non-dual the eighth consciousness?
Is that... No, that's still dualistic. You could say the non-dual is when the all eight are actually transformed into these four non-dual wisdoms. Well, for example, the eighth consciousness, they have these names, like the eighth consciousness is transformed into the perfect mirror wisdom. And that perfect mirror wisdom is non-dual experience. Because consciousness, as we said in class, it's termed vijnana. Vijnana is like divided knowing. It's dualistic knowing, but the vijnana is transformed into a jnana. So it's transformed into a non-dual knowing. But what those are, we can't really talk about. It's just making the point that there's very subtle levels of duality going on, even in just like very present mental consciousness. No, the names are, and there's not much commentary on what they actually are. I see it's time to stop too. But here's the names of the four wisdoms, is the four knowledges. They're called jnana, which is the same as vijnana without the vi. Because in Sanskrit, the vi means like to divide or to split. It's like split knowing is transformed into just knowing. And the first five consciousnesses, the sense ones, are transmuted into the knowledge of accomplishment. The sixth becomes the wondrous observing knowledge. The seventh becomes the knowledge of equality. And the eighth, Alaya, becomes the great perfect mirror knowledge. So. Yes, and they're also associated with the five Buddha families, yeah. Yeah, and also this is in the early Indian mind-only system, also in the East Asian, like to deal with this problem in the Chinese and Japanese version of mind-only, they add in a ninth consciousness. I think Tibetan systems don't do this. It's an East Asian thing. And the ninth consciousness is the perfect mirror, non-dual wisdom. Just to, like, well, what's all this is just a dualistic problem here. And so they call it a ninth.
These are like the latent wisdom seeds.
The latent wisdom seeds are what's going to actually transform the consciousnesses into wisdoms, according to the story. The wisdom seeds?
Yeah, in some sense they have like a habit or propensity.
They're more like, maybe we could also talk about them as, they're basically, they could be called Buddha nature. That's another story, that the seeds are what we could call the womb of the Tathagatas or Buddha nature that live in the mind of all sentient beings. But Dogen wouldn't like us talking that way, because... So, if you feel totally confused and disturbed by this, that's fine, because it's just a dream. And if it makes you want to investigate more, that's fine too. Those are the wisdom seeds knocking on the doors at the end of the long, dark alleys. We dedicate any merit arising from this conversation to the realization of mind only. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless.